Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, December 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Gambian President Adamawa Barrow has been declared winner of Saturday's vote.
Having received 4,427,419 votes in election, I hereby declare Adamawa Barrow duly elected.
We have analysis as some opposition candidates have rejected the results. Anglophone Cameroonians seek consensus amid a four-year-old conflict, and at least 33 bodies have been recovered from a sunken bus in Kenya.
I send my condolences to the families of beloved people who have perished in Mwingi in that very bad bus accident. And I urge all drivers, wherever the river is covered by water, please just wait. It is better than losing so many lives.
And the value of West Africa's three wealthiest men grew during the pandemic. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Gambia's Electoral Commission has declared President Adamawa Barrow the winner of Saturday's vote. But as Sergio Brito reports from Banjo, three opposition candidates have rejected the results.
Gambians on Saturday exercised their democratic right to elect a new leader. This is the first presidential election since the end of Yahya Jammeh's reign. The high-stakes presidential election was contested by ruling President Adamawa Barrow, his former sacked Vice President Usainu Dabo, and four other candidates, including one independent. Incumbent Adamawa Barrow won himself 457,519 of the total valid votes, earning himself re-election as chairman of the Independent Electoral Commission, Aliou Muhammad Njai announced.
I, Elimon Jai, presiding officer of the general election of 4th December 2021, having received 4,457,519 votes in the election, I hereby declare Adamawa Barrow duly elected to serve as president of the Barrow Gambia.
At a joint press conference, UDP leader Usainu Dabo, Mama Kande, and Esa Fall have unanimously agreed to reject the results of the election. Usainu Dabo told reporters their decision came following issues raised by their party agents and representatives at polling stations and the inordinate delay of results by the Independent Electoral Commission.
Considering that the Gambia has an electorate of approximately 900,000 with on-the-spot counting system, we are concerned that there has been an inordinate delay in the announcement of the results. Two, a number of issues have been raised by our agents and representatives at the polling stations, the centers, and at the IEC headquarters. As a result, the representatives of the aforementioned candidates at the IEC headquarters refused to endorse some of the results that were announced to the public media. We are investigating this matter with our partners to determine our future course of action. At this point in time, we reject the results announced thus far by the IEC.
Domestic observers and other stakeholders in a joint statement said the elections were conducted generally in an atmosphere of transparency and fairness. Saturday's peaceful elections has been seen by many as a win for democracy. Soon after the announcement, supporters of Adamawa Barrow hit the streets of Banjul to celebrate. Sergio Brito, VOA Daybreak Africa, Banjul.
An analyst says he believes Saturday's Gambian presidential election was largely free and peaceful and one of the best elections he has ever witnessed since the era of former President Yahya Jammeh 22 years ago. Sid Matijao, Gambian national investigator for Afrobarometer, says five opposition candidates each took advantage of Gambia's no-liberalized political environment and chose to compete individually rather than rallying around a single candidate.
James, this election is historical. It's unprecedented It has been one of the freest elections that the Gambia has ever organized, at least in my lifetime. I remember queuing for 2 hours, and the kind of discussions, the engagement, the hope, the serenity, the excitement in the face of many Gambians, old, young, finally voting for the first time in freedom and taking the destiny of their own country in their own hand. And so this election for me is historical. It's also the first time that I have voted without Yahya Jammeh.
There were 5 opposition candidates. Do you think they hurt themselves by not coming together and picking one candidate to go against Mr. Barrow?
Well, there have been calls for the opposition to unite. And of course, given the liberalized political environment, most of them think that they could have done it on their own. But if you look at the contest, of course, you know, there were some form of coalitions being formed. But you realize that Barrow had the, you know, bigger share where, I mean, his coalition, he referred to it as a grand coalition. So, of course, you know, coalitions might have created a more balanced, perhaps more close election. But, of course, this one was definitely decided by those that favored continuity and not those that wanted change.
During the campaign, we talk a lot about the role that the former president Yahya Jammeh was playing in the campaign. How much impact do you think his interjection into the campaign had on the results?
Well, Jammeh's back candidate had only about 12% of the vote. Of course, they came third, and that shows perhaps that Jammeh has been relegated into Gambian politics. And of course, this also shows the decrease in the number of the percentage of the vote that Mama Kande, who also came third in the 2016 election with 17%, also lose, declined at least by 5 percentage points. But of course, perhaps the involvement of Jammeh enabled Kande to have this number of votes, because Kande's party, the GDC, has been one of the most affected of the Barrow's cooptation strategy, including, you know, coopting the national chairman into his NPP party.
Of course, there will be the question of whether the elections were free and fair. You are in the Gambia. What's your own take?
Like I said, this election is the freest election that I've ever witnessed. There were no intimidation, there was no fear, there was a lot of options, you know, a lot of choice. But of course, the kind of narrative that has generated has basically reduced the conversation around 2 main political parties. And of course, that all had to do with the UDP, because the NPP could be said to be an offset of the UDP. This was seen more as a family affair, where the current president, Barrow, and his political godfather, Lawyer Dabo, engage in a contest. And of course, Barrow's rhetoric has always been retiring his father, and I think he has been able to do so. Of course, Usainu Dabo and Amama Kande and Esar Fall, you know, decided to disagree with the results and rejected the results and said until further investigation. So we are not sure civil society organizations released a statement, I mean, saying that the elections were free and fair. And so we're not sure what sort of claims they have, but I mean, the majority of Gambians agree that this election was free, fair, and transparent. And for the first time, this country has a very vibrant political environment where people are not afraid to show where they belong. And I think this has been very exciting for all of us.
Seth Matijao is the Gambian National Investigator for Afrobarometer. He was speaking with us from the capital, Banjul. Rescue operations to retrieve more bodies were continuing on Sunday in Kenya's Kitui County after a 51-seater bus plunged into a river on Saturday after being washed away by raging waters. At least 33 bodies were retrieved from the sunken bus, including a 9-month-old baby. 10 survivors are recuperating at the Kitui Level 4 hospital. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, rescuers expect to find more bodies. As reports indicate, the bus was carrying more than 60 passengers.
A video footage of the tragedy showed the bus being swept away as it attempted to cross the swollen river on Saturday afternoon. The overloaded 51-seater bus was ferrying family members and Catholic Church choir members to a wedding ceremony. One of the survivors narrates what transpired moments before the ill-fated tragedy took place.
Jana tulikuwa tunaenda kwa harusi kule jijini, ambapo tulifika katika mtu wenzio.
Yesterday we were headed to our wedding ceremony when we reached River Nzew, it had flooded, so we decided to wait for a while for it to subside. We waited for about 2 hours, then noticed some vehicles had successfully crossed over, and so we also decided to attempt crossing over. We got into the bus and also carried more passengers who requested for a lift. Halfway through the journey, the bus slipped and fell into the river.
Several hours later, a multi-agency operation led by Kenya Defense Forces to retrieve the capsized bus was successful on Sunday evening. The death toll as of Sunday evening was 33, with 10 survivors recuperating at Kitui Level 4 Hospital. Jess Mutua, one of the victims, who lost 15 family members, including his mother, siblings, and aunts in the tragedy, says the accident would have been avoided had there been a bridge across the river.
Unfortunately, I have lost like 15 family members because of negligence and poor performance of our politicians, our leaders. This bridge in Andakuzenga 2013, not even 2013, 2011. Up to date, the foundation stands to Zico Peke. And our leader, Tariki Kaloki Ngilo, flies in the helicopter while my mother sleeps there and my aunt sleeps there. Dead. I am very mad.
Local leaders visited the scene and condoled with the bereaved family members. Kitui County Governor Charity Ngilu acknowledged the loss of many lives and promised that plans are underway to construct a bridge over the river.
We have lost many lives in this river through this bridge, and I do hope this is not going to be a death trap every time we are having rains. Much as it is so painful, the people have felt fairly supported and comforted. I only want to say it's an accident. And I want to say here, when this happened, I also had a discussion. I called CS Macharia of Transport, and he said that this river, this bridge especially, is on course for it to be actually put up.
Machakos County Governor Alfred Mutua is urging drivers to be more vigilant, especially during this time when Kenya is experiencing heavy rainfall, which sometimes causes flooding in certain areas.
I send my condolences to the families, to the friends of beloved people who have perished in Mwingi in that very bad bus accident. I also condole with my fellow governor, Mama Charity Ngilu. This is a very heartbreaking time for all of us. And I urge all drivers at this moment, wherever the river is covered by water, wherever a place is covered by water, please, please, please do not play with water. Just wait until the water subsides. Just wait. It is better than losing so many lives.
Saturday's tragic bus accident is not the first time that lives have been lost in River Nzew, and the locals are calling for a quick action to be taken to avoid another tragedy. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa in Nairobi, Kenya.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butty in Washington. Today is Monday, December 6th. The conflict in Cameroon's English-speaking regions has been raging for more than 4 years now. An estimated 5,000 civilians have been killed. The United Nations says over 700,000 people have been internally displaced, more than 70,000 as refugees, and that less than 30% of the region's schools are operational. The Coalition for Dialogue and Negotiations in November this year met in Toronto, Canada, to find a consensus and build trust among Anglophone Cameroonians. Henry Atem is a founding member of the Coalition for Dialogue and Negotiations.
I think it's going well. We provided a platform for all the villages and the groups that attended the retreat to be able to share their experiences and to be able to educate people about the resolution that they collectively took, so that the people on the ground who are actually suffering should be able to understand that these stakeholders came together and this is what informed those decisions that they took. And we think that that education part was very necessary.
You mentioned stakeholders came together. Who are the stakeholders attending this meeting?
So the stakeholders that came together, we had self-defense groups, the political character, and those that have the defense character, like the ACOC, the Ambazonian Governing Council, Ayokta-based interim government, the Ambazina military force. You also had military independent self-defense groups like the Seven Kata, the Terminators of Ambazonia, and a host of others. But also, including to those that list, you had women's groups like the Southern Cameroon's Women's League, the Southern Cameroon European Women's, but also SNOT from Cameroon, the religious community. You had the Presbyterian Church, you had the Baptist Church, you had, I mean, a whole lot of other organizations that took part. I think over 30.
So you are seeking a consensual path to justice and peace in Southern Cameroon. What is the consensus path to peace?
What we did as the Coalition for Dialogue and Negotiation was, first of all, to have a consultation with all of these groups. That's the group that attended. We actually had meetings with them to get a pulse on how do they think that path to peace would look like. And from those consultations, it was clear that four different pillars would be discussed, one of which was the need for collaboration. The second was also the need to look at education, humanitarian access, and also human rights, especially for civilians, children, and women inclusive. And the general consensus among the groups that there is need for them to actually talk as one entity with the government of Cameroon. And lastly, the need for international mediation. So those are the four pillars that were discussed, and you could also see that reflected in the Toronto Declaration that the group themselves developed.
Henry, some people say this is a waste of time because whatever you decide, the Cameroon government, or as you would say, French Cameroon, will never accept what you come up with.
Yeah, no, I mean, you understand that there's no state party that has ever accepted mediation freely or negotiations freely out of their political will. It's never happened before. There's always a process, and the beginning of such legitimate and genuine processes always starts with the government being threatened by such moves. And we think that the moves that these stakeholders have taken is one that the international community appreciates. They were actually there. If the move was not a good one, they wouldn't have traveled to Toronto. They wouldn't have attended to this call. Still, in today's call, where the various delegates are sharing their experiences, you still have the international community actually dialing in to listen. That is evidence of the seriousness and the genuineness of this initiative. And we intend to move forward. Like I said, we never expected the Cameroon government to just accept it. It has never happened before.
Henry, it's so nice to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That was Henry Atem, founding member of the Coalition for Dialogue and Negotiations of Anglophone Cameroon. The collective net worth of West Africa's three wealthiest men grew by $6.4 billion during the first 17 months of the coronavirus pandemic, while 7 million jobs were lost in the region. According to Oxfam and Development Finance International, DFI, in a recent report, Kwesi Obeng, the co-author of the report, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the root causes of this inequality.
So that is quite a significant opportunity cost to particularly the most vulnerable in our society. And don't forget, women who occupy the kind of the lowest end in terms of the job ladder and also the informal sector have been impacted significantly. In fact, the region lost close to $48 billion in terms of the economic loss.
What is the systematic issue that allows during the same time period a few people to amass more wealth and many other people, a massive amount of people to lose wealth?
Well, so there are quite a number of factors. One of it is, so there are two ways to look at it. One has a domestic dimension, but there's also an international dimension. So in terms of the domestic dimension, one is that if you look at, for example, the fiscal regime or the tax structure, it punishes the poorest far more than the richest. So, for example, across the region, property taxation is just a tiny bit. In many parts of the region, it contributes just a tiny bit of it. It's because those who own the wealth are the ones who have to make the rules, and also those who have to police or implement the rules. And these are never implemented the way that would allow the countries to actually mobilize significant resources from, say, property taxation. And so you have a continuous rise in consumption taxes like VAT. I mean, Nigeria and Ghana, the two biggest economies in the region, have raised their VAT. And you know that VAT is actually a punitive tax for the poor.
So many of these taxes that are in place are more punitive for people with lesser amount of wealth than those with higher net worth is one of the issues in West Africa specifically.
Exactly. But there's also an international dimension. The international dimension is that you also have a system that basically does not properly tax the richest and also those who take advantage of the existing international, let's say, tax regimes.
Are you referring to such things as offshore accounts?
Offshore accounts. Yes, exactly. And the thing is that, and then also, you also have, these are people also who run big businesses, who take advantage of the loopholes in both the domestic laws as well as the international regime. I mean, just recently, the OECD inclusive framework agreed on some reforms of the international tax regime. So this top 1% also take advantage of the loopholes in the international regime to be able to ship their resources or the revenues they make out of these countries without paying adequately their fair share of the taxes in these countries. So what it means is that essentially it allows the richest to continue to be rich at the expense of the poorest or of the poor in the economies of these countries.
That was Kwesi Obeng, the co-author of a new Oxfam report about rising wealth inequality in West Africa. You are speaking to Ricky Stryak from Ghana. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the results from the second leg of the Total CAF Confederations Cup played across various venues on the continent on Sunday. Record three-time champions CS Faxien of Tunisia, 2020 champions RS Bakane of Morocco, Algeria's JS Saoura, and Zambia's Zanaco all qualified for the group stage of the 2021-2022 Total CAF Confederations Cup. The quartet completed a 14-team park in the mini-league stage with the last two seats to be determined between Al-Ittihad of Libya against Enyimba of Nigeria when they meet and JS Kabylie when they confront Royal Leopards from Eswatini. A look at some of the fixtures reveals some interesting encounters. Like in Bakar, Algeria's JS Samoura produced an amazing comeback to beat Ghana's Hearts of Oak 4-0 and reached the group stage winning 4-2 on aggregate. In Bamako, Mali's Binga couldn't find a similar comeback as they fell short to beat Zanaco 2-0, leaving the Zambians to reach the group stage winning 3-2 on aggregate. In all the matches, three-time Confederations Cup champions CS Faxien needed a lone goal to beat Kenya's Tosca and reach the group stage winning 1-0 on aggregate, while Morocco's RS Bakane survived an early scare to reach the group stage beating Rwanda's APR 2-1 on the night and in aggregate. Elsewhere, Egypt's duo of Pyramid FC and Al Masry also made it through to the group stage after two home 1-0 wins in Cairo and Alexandria, respectively, on Sunday. Meanwhile, in Benghazi, there was penalty joy for Ahlil Tripoli as they joined the group stage, beaten Stade Malien on shootout. In women's football news, Nigeria inched closer to the fourth round of the qualifiers for the FIFA Under 20 Women's World Cup Costa Rica 2022 after a healthy 4-0 away victory over Congo in Brazzaville on Sunday. The first leg of the third qualifying round for the FIFA Under 20 Women's World Cup Costa Rica 2022 saw Tanzania edged Burundi in a 5-goal thriller at the Azam Complex as the host earned a nervy 3-2 home win. Meanwhile, in Thie, Senegal boosted their chances of progressing in the next round of qualifiers with a 2-0 home victory over Guinea at the Stade La Dior. In Lusaka, Zambia and Ghana played out a goalless draw. The return matches have been scheduled for the weekend of December the 18th. In athletics, Kenya's Lawrence Cherono won the Valencia Marathon on Sunday after an incredible men's race that went down to the wire. Cherono, who finished fourth at the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Marathon, crossed the finish line first in Valencia with a time of 2 hours, 5 minutes, 12 seconds after a hard-fought last 500 meters where he passed Ethiopia's Chalu Desu and compatriot Philemon Kencharon. In the female category, another Kenyan, Nancy Jelagat, won the women's race with a time of 2 hours, 19 minutes, 31 seconds. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, November 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a great week.